2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andreas Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Bill Rogers is back with me. Anybody that listens to this program or has for a period of time knows that Billy comes in from time to time when he's in town, and he splits his time between Anaheim or Southern California and the Salt Lake City or Wasatch Front area.
Exactly. And this time is a twofold thing. We're going to talk about the first part now, and we're going to talk about the second part later because there's kind of fun things here. But we spent Friday and Thursday looking at the most incredible locomotives, steam locomotives, I have ever seen in my life.
You called me, I guess it was about, I don't know, a week or 10 days ago, maybe it was longer than that, and you sounded like a little kid on the other end of the phone.
Sound like a little kid on the other end of the phone.
That was one of the things I love about you. But this in particular, because the Spike 150 event was coming up, which is the 150th anniversary of the driving of the Golden Spike and the joining of the two links of track coming from east and west, and really changed this country.
Which it did.
And this reenactment happens all the time here, but this year happens to be the 150th anniversary, and you decided that you were going to do this.
And it turned out for the best, because with the help of a mutual friend and a friend of the show, Chris Dallin, we had a spectacular experience. Understand that the Union Pacific in the early 1940s built a total of 25 incredibly large engines so that they could haul freight between Cheyenne and Ogden. Simply because of the mountains, they needed something that had a lot of power, and they didn't have any time to build more tracks, so they built stronger engines that could haul longer trains. And this engine is called the Big Boy. 25 of them originally built. There are 8 still in existence, and there is one under its own steam. And we saw it on Thursday.
KSL Radio and Television have been right in the thick of this. As a matter of fact, one of the most envious pictures or videos I saw in the past couple of days was one of our reporters from Channel 5 actually getting to ride in the engine itself, waving at everybody as they went by. Alex Cabrero got that, and he posted on his social media. He said, you know, this might be one of the best work days I've ever had. But you decided that you were going to share this with a couple of guys that you know through your Disney connections.
Which I do.
That love trains.
And we're going to introduce them now. First of all, sitting to our left is a fellow by the name of Michael Campbell. Michael lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, and he is a train buff of such magnitude as to not be believed. He is the curator of not one, but I think a total of 4 different exhibits concerning Walt Disney and trains. And he made me a part of the second one, I think, when we created something for the Walt Disney Family Museum in San Francisco. He dragged me in. I was not kicking and screaming at the time. And we had a whole lot of fun. And that's kicked off all of this. And I've been trying to figure out a way to pay him back ever since. And I think we may have reached some sort of accommodation here. Not sure. We'll have to ask him in a minute. To our right is a young man whom I have known for the past 10 years, and he is a very special part of everyone's life.
Don't give it away yet.
Although I won't. I will not. We'll make him introduce himself here momentarily, but I will tell you that his name is Brett Iwan, and he, too, is a master craftsman of beautiful locomotive and rolling stock works, having his own garden railroad, and he and his father have put together a 7/8 scale model as well in his dad's backyard, and it's truly amazing. So,
for those that may have forgotten, Billy, of course, has been for more than two decades and probably closing in on three now, the voice of Disneyland, and I love to, you know, he's my show pony when I take him out. I always tell him to do the voice for everybody, but...
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, yep. Welcome to the Outdoor Show with Tim Hughes on KSL 1160 AM and 102.7 FM.
That gets me free burgers when we go out to lunch. All right. So that's how you get to know these guys. And we're going to talk about the Disney side of this in the second part of our conversation. But for now, I'm going to move over and talk to Michael for a minute. Just about the historical perspective of what this means. I said just a minute ago that Billy, when he called me, was like a little kid. You guys today, the smiles on your faces, I mean, I can't imagine what this must mean to you to come and see this.
Well, thank you for inviting me to be on your show, Tim. And you're right. It was just an unparalleled experience, one that I never thought would happen in my lifetime. Bill Rogers mentioned the Big Boy locomotive was the largest steam locomotive ever constructed. It has what we call a 4884 configuration, four leading wheels, 16 driving wheels, and four trailing wheels, and an enormous tender, 1.3 million pounds of steam power.
I've seen comparisons this week, both in length and in weight, to a Boeing 747.
That's exactly right. But unlike a Boeing 747, this is something that you get to experience firsthand, right up in front of you. And it rolled through towns, and people came out from everywhere to see this living legend, you know, go back under its own steam. We never thought this was possible. And kudos to the Union Pacific Corporation for making that investment in preserving our heritage and enabling so many of us to be able to experience it firsthand. It was truly remarkable.
You're a train historian. You know, it's sort of second thought here in Utah because it is something that happens every year, this reenactment of the driving of the Golden Spike. But it's hard to overestimate the impact that had on our country and really the world, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly right. And it's something that I think folks today have a little trouble connecting with because they're so used to automobiles and airplanes. Trains have been kind of relegated in the public consciousness to something that carries freight or something that slows me down when I'm trying to go home and it's crossing in front of me. But the stark reality is that the development of a transcontinental railroad was just as important to the development of the United States as our landing on the moon 100 years after that event. The United States, as it exists today, could not possibly have been created without coast-to-coast transportation. To put it in perspective, the world that existed at the time when the Golden Spike was driven was one that was lit by fire, and the only way you could travel around was animal power. Either a four-legged beast pulled you or a two-legged beast yourself walked. If you wanted to go anywhere of any significant distance, if you wanted to transport goods and services, railroads were it. It's what transformed the United States into a global economic superpower. You had local manufacturing and it was only able to be distributed locally. Now all of a sudden the whole country was opened up. It was as transformative as the net has been, to where you can get pretty much anything you want delivered anywhere you want. Well, subtract 150 years ago and that's what it meant to this country. It enabled the incredible economic boon. It invented the 20th century for the United States, and it is such an important artifact of our history to be recognized, celebrated, and understood.
I'm going to ask Brett this question in just a moment, but your connection to trains, you shared a little bit of it with me earlier today. Your connections to trains as a kid was profound, and you had a moment where, and you get a big smile on your face even thinking about it now, you had a moment in your life when you got to go up and actually blow the whistle on one, and it was almost a life-changing experience for you.
Well, it was more than life-changing. It was a seminal moment, and you could look at it as a blessing or a curse, depending on your perspective. I was 6 years old, my first trip to Disneyland. We lived in Northern California. My parents took me. It was a big train nut even by that age. As far as I was concerned, Disneyland was merely a railroad with some stuff in the middle. I didn't care about that. I had convinced my folks to let me dress up in bib overalls and the hat and the bandana. And the first thing I wanted to do when we got there was go on the Disneyland Railroad. The station agent sees this little kid dressed up as an engineer waiting there, all excited for the train to come in. When it arrives, he opens the gate. I go to run to get on a coach. He takes me by the hand. He says, come up with me, son. And he takes me to meet the engine crew. This is incredible, right? And I step up into the cab, and they start to explain how all the different controls work. And of course, I was 6 years old. I knew everything. I was going to teach them a few things. So we got to the point where it's time for the train to depart. And instead of asking me to leave, the engineer says, well, come on over here. And he picks me up and puts me on his lap. And he tells me to reach up and pull the whistle cord twice. And even at 6 years old, I knew what that meant. It means we're going. And he opens up the throttle. And I had the grand circle tour from the engineer's seat. And this experience, 50 years later now, I can tell you what it smelled like, what it felt like, the flash of light in the tunnels, the heat on my face. It was incredible. It was like being in a living beast, this thing. It was scary. It was exhilarating. We get all the way back around. And at this point, I finally remembered I did have parents. I had forgotten about that. And I go running up to go see them. And the next part I didn't remember until my mother reminded me of it a few years later. She said, well, how was? And, of course, I exploded like only a six-year-old boy could do. And towards the end of my diatribe, I said, when I grow up, I want a real Disney train in my backyard. And my mother did the typical mother thing. She said, that's sweet, dear, and patted me on the head and thought that was the end of it. 40 years later, I put a real Disney steam train in my backyard. And my mother reminded me of this story as we were putting it in. And she said, this just goes to show you, be very careful what you wish for. You're probably going to get it.
We won't give the whole story away yet because I want to save that for the second part. We're talking trains here. We'll talk about the Disney connection to it because Disney, quite honestly, and the connection to trains is inseparable. Anybody that knows Walt's history knows that he had trains in his backyard that he took his grandkids around on, tiny ones, but they were fully operational. And there's so many connections to the Disney family and the trains that now operate in the park. So we'll do that in our next segment, but I want to get Brett in here for a minute. Your connection to trains, before we get to your connection for Disney, which we'll do later, your connection to trains.
My connections with trains really starts with my dad. I grew up in a house that had model trains. From as early as I can remember, he had an HO scale layout in what became my toy room later on. And when I took it over as a toy room, he put the LGB G-scale train going around the family room ceiling. And then after he got bored with that, he turned the sandbox and swing set area into a garden railroad. All our family vacations were going to visit tourist railroads around the country. Of course, I experienced Disneyland as well, and similar to Michael, it was basically a train set with stuff in the middle. We went to Knott's Berry Farm all the time, where they have two 1881 Baldwin locomotives, steam locomotives operating. So I was just immersed in it. I've always been fascinated with nostalgia and history and mechanics, and trains kind of personified all of those things for me. Now, I also grew up as a big Disney and art fan, and I love the story of Walt Disney. And like you said, we can talk about that later. But I remember as a kid wanting to learn to draw and being fascinated by Walt's story. Learning that trains were an important part of his story was so exciting and fascinating to me. The older I got, admittedly, I kind of started to steer away from the train fandom a little bit. You know, I went to college. I was starting my career, and trains became that thing that I used to like and my dad still liked, but I wasn't really all that into it. And then, as I got older, I kind of rediscovered it. I found some model trains that Bachman had produced that were the C-19 Baldwin locomotives that Knott's Berry Farm has, and those were always my favorite trains. And I thought, well, now I have to have those. That's what I dreamt of having as a kid. So I got those, and I started a garden railroad in my backyard, and then that kind of turned into, it kind of reinvigorated the hobby and the bonding that my dad and I had over that hobby. Fast forward a few years later, my dad has this idea. He's going to build a half-scale replica of the old Mine Train Through Nature's Wonderland Railroad attraction that was at Disneyland. And when he told me that, I said, okay, Dad, sure. And he starts building it, and I would go home to visit every once in a while, and I'd look in the garage, and I thought, holy crap, this thing's turning out. This is real. So, you know, he keeps building the locomotive. And at that point, I thought, you know what? I'm tired of being a train fan. I'm tired of being what we lovingly refer to as foamers, standing on the sidelines, gawking at the locomotives, listening to the sound, smelling the smell of the coal or the wood or the oil, whatever it's burning, and thinking, oh gosh, it's so cool. I just love that thing. But never really understanding how it really worked. I'd gone to the museums, I'd seen the diagrams, but I'm a hands-on type of guy. And I decided, I want to operate these things. I want to learn. So I reached out to this family that I'd met actually through some Disney connections, and they invited me up to their family-run railroad where they work and service steam locomotives for people around the country. And they were very gracious in letting me stay with them and work with them over the weekends, and started teaching me some steam mechanic principles. And then from there, I found out that Knott's Berry Farm was hiring, and I thought, well, why not fulfill that childhood dream and actually work on those trains that I love so much? And I started working there last summer. And so I just kind of took it into my own hands, as it were, to learn about this art form, really, lost art form that is railroading, and especially steam railroading and steam locomotives. So
we're having this conversation, of course, because Spike 150 is happening, or has happened this week by the time this interview airs. But we're going to take a break. Next hour, we're going to come back and talk about the Disney connection here. Bill and I have had this conversation, certainly personally, and I think we've probably done it on the radio too, that dreams really do come true. And it's important to have those dreams and those goals. From Michael's time as a six-year-old kid getting to ride in the cab and run the controls of the train at Disneyland, to Brett's desire to be an artist, be an animator for Disney, and what he's doing now, which we'll tell you about, and Bill for the last two or three decades being the voice of Disneyland after being a radio guy just like me. It's inspiring to sit at the table with these guys and share it. But the connections between trains, Disney, and Abraham Lincoln. We had our picture with Honest Abe today, and we'll tell you why these two guys actually have the ability to have a train in their backyard. We'll do that next hour. Stay with us.
Papa was a fisherman. Papa was a fisherman. He loved his cars and his steel guitar.
Hang on, Russ. Here it comes. Sing it, Mike. Your big moment.
Ooh-wee.
A fishing man. Speaking of a fishing man, I know this is Mother's Day, but there's a lot of testosterone in the room here with four of us. And Navidomskis on the phone, who is a walking testosterone all by himself. I posted this on our Facebook page. It says, give a man a fish and you feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish, and he has to buy graphite rods, reels, spinner baits, jigs, crankbaits, jerk baits, plastics, flies, waders, a boat, and a truck.
Yep. Right. Not necessarily in that order.
Not in that order. You need the boat and the truck first. Navidomskis is on the road today. Are you finally, a week later, going to divulge where you went fishing last week?
Yeah. We were at Little Creek Reservoir outside of Randolph, Utah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And it's small. I mean, it's a small lake. And I always pick it, not always, but I pick it early in my flow tube class because it's safe. I mean, if my students get blown to the other side, we can drive around and get them.
Right.
That far.
Right.
And it was windy. Holy cow. We faced serious wind all day long. My poor students were battling with that. And when they don't know what they're doing, it was difficult. So we caught fish. I mean, not a lot. I put 14 in the net personally, which, you know, I want more than that. We want 25. That's kind of a baseline goal. But I have three students right now with zero still. So they're hoping for good things this week.
Well, hopefully that wind dies down today. Looks like it's going to be a picture-perfect day. Your concern going up there, though, was that water had dropped so low, you were afraid there might not be any fish in there.
And I'm glad to report that turns out the fishing game put in fish in November, and they put in good-sized fish. So every fish we caught was identical. So they were cookie-cutter, as they say, and they were about 15 and a half, between 15 and a half and 16. They were good size. And they're all from the same stocky moment. So they really did die. These were every fish we caught was the exact same fish from the November stocking, which I guess they lost everything before that. You know, I've caught them over 20 there a few times. But we kind of, but these, the breed they put in were phenomenal. They hit like a ton of bricks and they got up in the air. They were jumping fish. They were really strong fighting fish. I'm not sure if they were Kamloops, and I wondered if they were. I'm going to look that up, but I think the Fishing Game did a fabulous job at stocking a really ferocious trout in that water, and they thrived through the winter. So I doubt that it's going to drain this year. I think we got enough water, they're going to make it for a couple years. Well, by next year, those fish will be nice fish.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up about the water, because there's a big headline on KSL.com's page that says, Utah is drought-free.
Yes.
Thanks to fantastic snowpack. But as temps warm, will rivers flood? We had Brett McInerney on from one of the hydrologists in the state of Utah. He was saying yesterday that it's playing out almost perfectly. We've had moderate temperatures, 50s, 60s, some 70s, and that it's the streams like Big and Little Cottonwood Canyon that, you know, get their runoff from up high that may be running high or fast in the next little while, which everybody needs to be aware of. But no worries about water this year. And
no.
If we manage it properly, it's also going to help us out next year as well.
Absolutely. This was a godsend. It was perfect. You know, and the fishing that we had fishing struggles the last week of my beginning class, but it had more to do with all the rain than the runoff. So, the runoff is going to come down nice and slow the way we like it.
Talking about stocking, a couple of things on our Facebook page. If people want to follow us there, it's just KSL Outdoors Radio. But there's a story we shared about Pineview Reservoir being replenished with one of its largest releases of 28,000 tiger muskie.
And, yep, I heard that.
Yeah, story about that. And then there's a picture that I hope you got a chance to take a look at from Pennsylvania of a guy holding a 50-pound monster catfish, which is supposedly a new Pennsylvania record. So
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah.
What are you going to do with that?
Well, he's got one hand in his mouth, which I don't think is a good idea at this point.
That's how you hold catfish.
Yeah, well, I remember those stories. What do they call that? Canoodling?
Yeah, noodling. I don't know. Was this one noodles?
I don't know.
But you hold them in the mouth. They have side fins that are spiny bones that'll hit you. So that is how you hold a fish. A catfish. If you pull a bass's lower jaw down, it paralyzes them. So you can hold a bass that way really easy. So.
Yeah, the noodling thing is still an amazing story to me, where these people put the bait in their hand and they just reach down in a fishing hole in the river because they know there's a monster catfish, and the catfish comes up and swallows their hand, and that's how you get them out of the water.
You know, I have done that, Tim, and there's no bait in the hand.
Oh, there isn't?
It's just the hand.
No, when they grab onto your arm, basically your hand, then you grab the lower jaw and then you wrestle with them to get them out.
We only have literally 15 seconds, but have a great day on the water today with your students.
I will, thank you.
Weather's going to be perfect.
The boys got home from Pyramid, so they got some Lahontan trout.
Oh, good.
Mickey Finn's something, I don't know, Instagram to see those photos.
All right, we're out of time. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Live breaking news now on the mobile app for KSL News Radio. Listen at home or anywhere you go. Brought to you by Any Hour Services, KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City, KSL News Radio. This is Utah's news station.